It might be well, just at this stage, since we are, we've been promising but not delivering as well on the discussion element, I think it might be well just to reestablish once more what the framework of Kohlberg is by recasting it just slightly in terms of some basic principles that he finds important, and then maybe open it up for as far as we can go in terms of our discussion. Remember this, Kohlberg says in the first place that morality does develop in stages, and when their basic values seem to be different, it's basically because we're at different stages, not because necessarily the value itself, well, the value itself is of course different when it's reconceptualized, but it's because we're looking at it from a different angle. Jerome Bruner said an interesting thing about this when he was trying to talk about what education is like. Let me just see if I can, yeah, thank goodness I have this quote here anyway. He said this, that basically education is going back on your experience and reconceptualizing it into more powerful systems of thought. And that's one of the best ways of describing education I've ever heard. The notion that how much, after all, is new in the world in terms of the in terms of ideas, but we go back and visit ideas, and we get more power from them because perhaps we are getting more powerful in our capacity to conceptualize. And as we go back on them, of course, this was the kind of conceptualization that gave rise to what was called the spiral curriculum, that you don't misteach anything at a lower level for fear that you're going to have to reteach the whole business later on. This was indeed, for better or for worse, the origin of new math and things like that. That if you're going to teach mathematical principles, teach them the way that you will have, that you can, that you don't have to reteach mathematics when you get onto a college or university level, as many people do, like the whole notion of negative numbers. Well, in a sense, that principle is operating here in terms of moral development, that we go back on our acts and reconceptualize them in terms of even more powerful powerful meanings. And that is this ripple effect that we were referring to yesterday. The me, that's the only reality, but there's a meaning beyond me, and that is the meaning of others. And there is a meaning beyond me and others. So, first of all, the notion of that morality develops in stages is important. And that a second principle goes that everyone passes through these same stages of moral development. We may go through them at different rates. Some zip through. As a matter of fact, when they were talking about the stage theory, Bill alluded to it's a very popular thing. Well, it has been around for a while in personality development as well. And some had said, well, you could say that Mozart was a self-actualized person when he was 8 years old. It takes most of us 40, 50 years before we get to be self-actualized. It's the same thing here in terms of moral development. It seems some people go through this at a much more increased rate, and I think we begin to sense them out. Larry Collins and I were talking about one of the faculty members here whom we both greatly admire. Last night, and I mentioned at that time that one of my criteria for describing a person who is always impressive is his purity. His purity. And I don't know why I use that term purity, but I suppose I kind of mean a kind of consistency, but something that is so encompassing, a person who feels so far beyond his own selfish interests that he overwhelms you with his purity. And that kind of thing, we discern those people. It doesn't take a psychology major to discern that. You know who these people are. You know what when you watch, when you come into contact with them, that you're almost overwhelmed by them. Well, we do proceed at different rates. And I think that at each time in our life, significant times in our life, when we were in grade school, when we were in high school, and in college perhaps, we've come across those specially marked people that seem to be beyond the average in our group, and whom you look to for a kind of moral leadership. We do go at different rates. It's one of the basic principles. It's an obvious one. Right along with that, by the way, he says these six sages are indeed sequential. They can't be skipped, even though they may look like they're skipped, and some of them might be compressed. But a third principle is this, that moral reasoning is related to behavior. I was wondering whether any of you could say, we're here, we're talking, aren't we talking morality more, or doesn't Kohlberg really do more talk about morality? Where is his behavioral base? Well, he wants to establish that he's certainly interested in behavior, but he also says there is a mental component to this, that indeed, as our capacity to abstract our experiences grows, we are capable then of tapping into areas of experience far beyond ourselves. This is, for example, the blessing of literacy, that we expand our personal experience, which would be extremely limited in a concretistic world where we only can see each other on a day-by-day basis, but to expand our world far beyond that because we're endowed with literacy. Likewise, here, that when we talk about morality, we expand our conceptualization of morality as we are able to hook it into principles and systems and even theory, if we can stand that word without gagging. Then he does end up by saying that discussion is needed for moral growth. We can't grow morally unless we talk about it. And this reminds me of a couple of shared conversations that some of you have said, well, we talked about this and began to match our own experience with it. And we said yes to it, or we said no to it, as the case may be. But we do talk into morality. Morality is not advanced unless we talk about it. The civil rights movement of the 60s did not happen just in a vacuum, in a verbal vacuum. It happened with a lot of talking. Of course, morality cannot stop at the verbal level, but it certainly is enhanced and created or cultivated with the moral level. So, just then, the commentaries on this, moving from this stage, from one lower stage to another, does involve risk. It's something new. It does involve risk. Someone who is at a higher stage can help others who are at a lower stage in moving up. And I think this is the point of being with people, in a sense, nobler than we are, or larger than we are. Not that we exploit them, but that we benefit from them, because they are capable of benefiting more. And in turn, that we react that way toward those who that sounds presumptuous, and I'm sure there's no way of saying that modestly, but saying that who are in a stage of morality lower than we. And I think that can be understood properly when we have in this social upheaval that we're having, where many values are being challenged, where integration is still not a realized event, and where political disparities are so agonizingly involved with us, you know, the great Nixon resignation and everything that was left in its wake, where there was anger there, and people were arguing from different levels of moral reasoning. And it's very easy for someone who perhaps has the benefit of a more abstracted experience to look down at that. If that happens, that's tragic indeed. It is tragic indeed. It's, I think, an important thing, in the final commentary here, before we just simply open it, that people at higher levels can always understand the motivation of those at lower levels, but the reverse is not true. The reverse is not true. And I think whenever we've experienced that, either from top down in our dialogue or from our position up to another, and not understanding what in the world that person is talking about, it may indeed be a reflection of this fundamental principle. And it's something to remain very sensitive to, certainly not in the put-down thing, but again in the community upbuilding thing. The reality is this, that the higher the stage that one gets to, the more likely that one is going to be misunderstood. I think that's going to be a very valuable thing to continue with. How difficult it was for us also to understand our parents' reasoning at times in their value system. How strangely paradoxical it is that when we transcend our own parental value system, that we know that they cannot understand us. And it works that way. Now, I thought maybe that little statement might be kind of helpful for us. We can open it up for casuistry, I suppose. What do you do if you want to work on that level? If you want to work on a conceptual level, fine. Where are we going? Yeah.
I have a question. Do you ever approach these levels with the mind that maybe a person doesn't have genetically or physically the capabilities of reaching all up to the sixth level? And what do you do with the person if he remains at one level? Do you approach that differently? Or do you assume a sort of different range for that person, allow him to keep his own morality and have your own at the same time?
You know, most people are incapable of sixth level morality. One of the reasons why I tossed in the question at the end of the period yesterday about what constitutes morality, because it's very easy to assume that unless you are sixth level, you are sub-moral or immoral or something of that sort, and very few people do reach sixth level. And to pick up Wayne's last comment, I suspect that most of them that do get to sixth level have a very difficult life. Because on the one hand, it's frustrating because they understand other people and other people don't understand them. And some of their ways of behaving may look very eccentric to other people because other people are judging them in terms of the level they've gotten at.
Now, my question is, a person who has reached the sixth level, I understand it, he has taken a look at his beliefs. He has internalized his beliefs, and now, from that point on, he actually, all of his actions stem from those beliefs. So, actually, he should be a very clear person to us.
No. No, because we react in terms of the way that we formulate our judgments.
May I ask Bill before you continue, what do you mean by he should be a very clear person to us? You mean easily spotted?
Easily understood me. If he believes in exactly, if he does exactly what he believes, he is not only performing consistently, but he's also thinking consistently. In which case, I would think that if a person is at that sort of level, maybe that's exactly what you're talking about, that overwhelming quality about someone.
Yeah. Well, it varies. Because probably the most obvious and most easily understood person is the stage one person. You know exactly why they're behaving the way they do. They want this. They don't want that. It's a sheer reaction to the situation. Little kids are very obvious. And stage six people are the hardest. I mean, they are the most complex persons.
May I suggest, though, that you can get to that in two ways. It's more, I think we discern stage six people better on an intuitive level than on a rational level. I think their capacity for integration transcends most of our capabilities, and we cannot get to that all that easily. But we feel, if you can keep me from being mawkish, I don't want to be mawkish about it, but the notion of the aura, an intuitive response that here's a person who has put it together. I tend to think of these people as being rather serene. It's not that they're not in touch, but they are in touch very much, and it doesn't upset them because they are internally put together. You know, they can see that there are irregularities that are irregularities, but that they can be transcended.
Wasn't it true that most people who are below that level six look at them and think they're damn fools for acting the way they do?
Because
they're making life uncomfortable for themselves, and they're not in the general flow. And why in the heck do you want to live like that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. That I think this a good example of that might be someone, of course, the best example, one of the great examples would be Schweitzer. You know, why would a guy with all of that going for him, you know, philosophy, theology, music, why would he go down there and serve them, you know, them, dangerous place? Couldn't understand, how many people could not understand his value system? They couldn't even get to it. But how many in turn finally were very much impressed by saying, wow, that guy is put together. I don't know how, but he sure is put together.
Well, wouldn't it be like Mark when we talked about two and Jesus? Because he would obviously be at the sixth level. And about recognizing him, he did these things very, very consistently, and yet people just couldn't understand his motivations at all. And even the disciples that, when he was really telling these things to, they couldn't understand what he was trying to say.
And his modalities were not necessarily descriptive, going back to them. That is, saying, this is how I want you to understand it, like a scientific formula. He gave them ambiguity to grow to grow into. He gave them parables. He didn't give them specific explanation. And it all is, like Walt was amazed, you know, about the lack of the power of the miracles. I'm always amazed, I'm sure you are too, about how the disciples, after being with him 3 or 4 years, finally said, oh, I think we're catching on to what you're saying.
And they were wrong.
Yeah.
And they thought they were catching on, they were totally wrong. And he said, listen, I go to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah. You put together with that most of the Pharisee involvements are with stage four people, who are very strongly trying very, very hard to carry out the law purely and to lead legally perfect lives and to to make the law a living force once again among the Jewish people as it was at the time of Moses or whenever. And so you take Sermon on the Mount and see it that way, you know, and he says, you've heard from old times do so and so, but I say to you, and that's sixth level talk, but I say to you, you know, and they can't handle that. See, you are talking against the foundations of my existence and saying that they are inadequate. So you're destroying my life, my rational structure. And it's very frustrating for a stage four person to get the foundations rocked on their structure. Mm-hmm. That's why they fight back so fiercely to defend it.
But Jesus being at stage six can help them move up if they're willing to be moved, is that it?
Well, it could rock the foundations and challenge. What he did was, he would do two things. He could not move them verbally, and so he did the sign, as John put it, you know, which they had to accept as a prophetic act. Well, if it's a prophetic act, and this is a prophet, and therefore if he's a prophet, what he's saying is right. So you got to buy what he's saying. Therefore, what we have thought was the law wasn't the law, and what he's saying is the law. But I don't believe it.
But they're still at stage four then.
Oh yeah, sure. And but he shakes them up, and they have to reconstruct their whole life.
Which is the notion, the reconstruction.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But if you shake too hard, like the assimilation contrast, you know, you're going to just further reinforce them or further alienate them into where they're at. So I think it has to be, you know, you have to kind of come toward them and pull them along.
Yeah, you can shatter them too.
Yeah.
I don't think that someone who is at an advanced stage has that, has a kind of a messianic complex in a negative sense of saying, now I want the others to feel just like I do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
There is, I think, an interesting distinction in dynamics that shifts from the lower stages to the upper stage. And I think ones who are arrested on the lower stages, and I would say the first three, actually the fourth stages of the law and order is a pivotal stage. It's a kind of a betwixt between kind of thing. But on the first three level, I would say characteristically, these people reflect a tremendous need to control the life that they're living. And by controlling, I don't mean having power over it necessarily, but understanding the rules of the game. For example, to control their life can mean going to a factory and just simply doing the thing on a repetition level, day by day by day by day. That is one way of controlling, because you are also going to control the regularity of your paycheck. You're going to have all the predictables in your life fairly well taken care of. Now that dynamic shifts. The ones who shift into the higher gear level of the upper stages do not have that concern about controlling, because they have they grasp the reality that they cannot control everything, but they're capable of living in yes, they also understand that, but they are capable of living better with ambiguity. The ones on a lower level cannot. If you're stuck on a lower level, you can't tolerate a whole lot of ambiguity in your life, so you control it by reducing your risk level. As you move into a higher gear level here, in terms of morality, also you're capable of risking more. And this is, I think, so beautifully epitomized that Jesus could risk sitting down with sinners. He could risk it. He wasn't thinking, what consequence is going to be to me? He could risk that. Now that's
he had to risk it, right?
No, he didn't have to risk that. No.
Yeah, he did. If he was at that level, that was necessitated by his being there. That he just couldn't reduce himself not to do that.
All right. I think we'll be talking. That's not bad. In other words, to be what he had to be, he had to do this.
Right.
But there was no monkey on his back to do it.
Oh no.
You know, this was the way he was.
Right.
And it's something that we can't ponder, because we oftentimes gauge relationships in terms of penalties. No. What will it look like if I associate with that person? Just think about how we do that on a neighborhood level. What would it look like if I associate with the town bum, maybe, or the neighborhood alcoholic, or you know, whatever the case may be, or those who are not well liked in the congregation? Will that rub off on me, and I won't be so well liked? You know, that all these little self-aggrandizing strategies, if they could only come back to us as a mirror to say, where am I? They kind of revealed, where am I?
Before we go on here, let me jump back to Lyman, because I was thinking we never answered your question. Let me ask you whether you were asking whether or not a sixth-stage person has a moral obligation to function as teacher.
Well,
is that what you were asking?
I was thinking also along those lines, and plus, you know, basically that was it.
Yeah, I suspect so. I suspect that, you know, it's like Plato's divided line in the myth of the cave, and once you've been outside and seen what reality is really like, you have an obligation to go back down in the cave and tell them they're looking at shadows. And they may say you are a complete idiot. You don't know what you're talking about, you know. Shadows, those things are, you know, there's nothing more real than that. We've seen them all our lives.
Well, okay, but along that line, I was thinking, when people stop at certain levels, you know, what do you do? I mean, how do you, you know, deal with that?
There are so many pejorative notions of what of teaching and teacher, you know. All of us have bad notions of that, even from grade school, and say, well, teacher. To be a teacher, you must first be a lover. If you cannot be a lover, you cannot be a teacher. And I think the notion of bestowal is a very dangerous notion if teaching is going to take effect. I think you've got to love. And again, I know I always border here a little bit on, I don't want to get this trivialized into some sort of a warm interpersonal relationship. I don't mean that necessarily, that we have to be lovey, you know, the touchy-feely necessity. But to love a person, or to love strongly enough, is the requirement, it seems to me, for teaching.
Along that line, that if you realize that you are dealing with someone that is not at the same level as you are, and you've come along so far with them and finally realize that maybe this is far as his personal growth. Is
yeah.
that the enemy responsibility at that point?
There your point is, yeah. yeah.
Well, your responsibility is to accept them
as they are,
and as far as they can get, yeah, you can pray that something's going to happen, and it's amazing. You know, we have a tendency, you know, we're just starting to get over the tendency of believing that people are locked into their IQs. You know, and people are capable of moral greatness that they're totally unaware of. Oftentimes it's the situation that commands it out of them. And oftentimes when you get in a crisis situation, it is not the so-called official moral leaders of the group that are the saints. You know, it's the little nobodies that emerge. Yeah, right, that's right, yeah. And so, you know, don't just write somebody off as eternally lost at level 4 and never going to get beyond it. But it's extremely difficult to get from 4 to 5. And sometimes it takes a crisis to break them loose from it.
Maybe a more crisis.
Harold, you want to? Yeah, well, I, with what you're saying, extremely, I see the difficulty, I think, going from 4
yeah.
on because of the law. It was structured under the law, in the family law, in the church, everything, you know. And I know I, as a child, didn't want to go against my parents' ways. Even though I didn't believe the same way or understand things that way. So it was really difficult because you're going against someone you love dearly and against this great.
Against the majority.
And then in the church the same way. You know, how it's awfully difficult to get to stage 6 because then, you know, people say, well, you think you're above the law, you're above the church, you know more. You know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Better than the whole thing. And it's really difficult to move into that area.
Maslow says something interesting about this, and I really think I'd like to share that. And that is the notion of saying a self-actualized person, which is put at the 6th level, is oftentimes also misunderstood. But that moving from stage to stage is like an experience in what could be called successive liberation. You are freed from a small cage, indeed to a larger cage. There are always cages, you know, but you're freed then to a larger cage and to a larger one. Now, maybe the cage is a bad metaphor, maybe it's a bad image, I don't know. But this notion of successive liberation is, there is a sweetness. There is also a little bit of the sour. The ones in the smaller cage are going to say, what is he doing up there? Or what are they? What? Why can he live that way?
Who do they think
and
they
I
are?
Can't. And who do they think they are? That's
yeah.
right. But it's the response cannot be anything, again, except a concern, a nurturing, a loving response.
And then again, I think speaking to what you were saying, I think you can't see. If I run around spending my time trying to change somebody, I'm going to be frustrated. Because I can't change anything.
Yeah, they are.
You know?
Yeah.
But once I accept them, then I allow them to change. But as long as, with my family, as long as I'm bucking, we're going to do this way, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's going to be this, you know. And when I let go, then they can change.
The changing mentality is on the conformity level. It's not on the other levels. It's a... you know, it's my mission to change another person. That's that's not characteristic of the upper levels.
Cool.
I was going to say, I guess just what you did, I think it seems to me that the person at level 6 is very accepting of the people that are below them. Even though they're misunderstood, it doesn't bother them and they can accept the people who are below them.
Yeah.
When they're functioning,
bear in mind
that, you know, we're talking positively. And it's also, I mean, you don't stop sinning when you get to level 6 or anything like that. You can get very frustrated. You can get angry and you can behave in immoral ways. You can behave in sinful ways and so on. And you can also behave in other kinds of ways.
That's the image I was thinking of how we could change. When we say above and below, we do mean superiority, inferiority. I wonder if we couldn't think of ahead and behind.
Yeah.
like on a trail, you know, to see that the person who's ahead is not only seen what you've seen, but he's seen more. And there is more ahead. And there is more ahead, rather than up above, which you could just say more as the king downward look. Huh? Yeah.
And besides, level six people simply don't function there all the time. I mean, they come up, they raise the belt, they may achieve that in one area of their life, and another area of their life they may be on level four and stay there for ever.
Right. But that, and also, level six people care what other people think about them, just like level one. You don't leave that behind, that part of your personality. Really, it's more cumulative. You don't become anti-law and order because you're at level five or level six. And usually you become more capable in the legal area than the level four person is. So you don't leave it behind and it's something different, but you kind of move beyond it.
Phyllis has been reading.
Okay, Phyllis.
Mine is really changing the direction back to the child. But I was just listening to a tape on baptism, specifically infant baptism, and it bridges me. For one thing, we've talked morality, which could be a humanistic sense. I'm anxious to get us into the Christian sense of morality. But the struggle there was in terms of the kingdom of grace, that as a child is brought into the lifestyle of justification and redemption, sometimes by our punishing, we bring him into a feeling of self-vindication. It was Walt's tape, and he was talking about his little boy who wouldn't admit that he had made all these pencil marks on the door because he was afraid to be punished. And he said, we don't teach confession. We teach self-vindication because we have to, now I don't know how to fit that together at all, but if they have to go through the punishment stage as a child.
Let me toss one back to you, Phyllis. If everybody starts out at stage one, which is our values get formed by other person's approval or disapproval of us. In other words, our motivation is totally external. And if by baptism, we get an internal motivation where God motivates us to behave in certain ways. Do we move to another stage by virtue of baptism?
No, I'm asking you.
It's our responsibility to challenge, not to answer.
Although, that's a very real question. A partial response to that is that there...
When we talk about successive liberation, there is also responsibility of those who are in more powerful positions immediately around us to help us maybe bootleg the key into us, to open up our little cage to go into the next cage. And I think that, in a sense, that's the kind of parental responsibility that happens, of saying that our cage keeper at that point can, if he's going to keep us imprisoned, and parents tend to do this sometimes, keep us imprisoned in that small cage, the only rules of the game that we can work with are the rules of that cage, of that small cage. One of them, if it's going to be systems of reward and punishments solely, then the child is going to figure out, well, self-vindication is the best possible solution. And he's right. He's right on target. Because that's his only options within that small cage. But those who are in power, and those who are perhaps more liberated, can help the child see that there is more, open up the cage to a greater life, an opener life, to where we don't have to spend our time in this demeaning enterprise of self-vindication, of it's all right, I'm all right, and I want you to know I'm all right.
But he has to go through those stages first.
Well, of course, he's demonstrating that he has gone through at least the first stage. Now, I think that those who are in power around him what it amounts to is to say, okay, this really tells me that I've been punishing too hard or rewarding too much for mean enterprise. Can I ease off of that?
I'm really struggling with one tiny additional thought. That is the concept of, is it possible to be regenerated? I mean, are we born again consciously rather than through baptism? And I remember teaching a 5-year-old child whose family did have adult vacuum, or at least vacuum in space. And the mother at that point came very happily one day and said he had asked to be baptized, and I was so thrilled because he had given his life to the Lord. Now, I believe if there is this activating force in that moment, then he does bridge into better reasons for morality, if that's the word.
Well, he gets to a higher, to a more advanced stage, sure. But it does. I mean, and regeneration is not limited to baptism.
But could we leave that question?
As a matter of fact, with adult baptism, with adult baptism as we do it, the adult baptism has two functions. One is to give a visible testimony to one's fellow believers that one is a fellow believer, and the other is to be received by God, officially adopted by God as his child. But faith is there already.
But that question, basically, is in the arena of God's mercies, and it's not within the arena necessarily of our mercies. I think how this happens in baptism, again, this good thing that Walt said the other morning, saying, water is God's means of grace. People are God's means of grace too, but we know a little bit more than about our conscious involvement in being people than we do in the mysteries of water regeneration. And that's my bias. Psychologically, as a psychologist, I would say we should concentrate on how do we mediate God's will and goodness to those around us. We can't do much about that water. And we can speculate on it in terms of its power, but I don't think the mystery will ever be solved for us. But there are dynamics about our relationships that can be addressed under the nature of God's will.
Let me add one more point in connection with what you raised, Phyllis. Oftentimes what happens when we're dealing with children as Christians, we treat them as stage one people, but we substitute for parental approval and disapproval, Jesus' approval and disapproval, don't we? And we hold them, we attempt to force them to be stage one type people with a God whom we may be forcing a kind of pious paganism on them, where they have a God who threatens or rewards depending on whether they're good or bad.
I think this is somehow related to your question, and it goes back to the discussion before. I'm a little bit puzzled about the notion of understanding that's been developing, and about the relationship that you mentioned between thought, that is, thinking about moral achievement and moral action. I take it that the six stages in some sense represent a progression of understanding. One becomes in possession of greater, different sorts of understanding, and I'm not sure just what that is. I think all of us know people whom we admire greatly, who seem to possess this purity you were speaking of. We're somehow simple people of faith whose intellectual comprehension of moral issues is something that simply don't bother us. It never occurred to them. And I think we also know people who perhaps can discourse ultimately on some categorical offense, but in the terms of their moral behavior are unfair, small people. And so it seems to me that the notion of understanding and the suggestion of the stages of the development of understanding is puzzling. I just wonder if
that's very good. It is paradoxical. Harold's voice is very quiet. Now, did you get what he was dealing with about saying there can be the simple? Is it possible to have simple people at stage six and complex intellectually people operating at a more demeaned or meaner level? And paradoxically, you don't see much of that in literature, but I would say yes. I think the my vision is of this, as a little boy, I can remember seeing a sparkling old lady introduced to my parents. And I was just kind of watching what she'd do, and they talked about a mutual acquaintance. And this little old lady was just sparkling, and she said, "Oh, he was a great person. He enjoyed a little smutty story now and then." And I thought, what a marvelous term, smutty story now and then. And really what she was saying to me, both about herself and about that person, was that we are not captured on the level of a mean morality of saying, well, a little, you know, is a little dirty joke never heard on stage six. No, you incorporate it. You incorporate it. And you don't, it doesn't have to be necessarily a complex thought-out event, but a thought-out event. There are times when, I'm sure that little old lady would know, when she was not going to obey.
I wonder if it was more of a process of being able to articulate what I'm doing. You know, the kind of simple person you're talking about may understand, but may not be able to articulate it to somebody else, and so therefore we assume that they don't understand in their own being what's going on. Whereas the more articulate people will be able to, you know, say all kinds of things and understand them without doing it.
And simple people maybe don't. Mm-hmm. They realize they don't need it.
But they may, that, yeah. But they still may be. Yeah. At that.
Yeah, that their articulation is their action.
Yeah. Their serenity, too, or their sureness. You know, that they're not plagued. I think it's a good mark of this. Harold, is they're not plagued by self-doubt. No, saying, should I have done that or not? They do it. They do it. Should I sit? Phyllis and I have this. Should I sit in the front row or not? You do it. You know, you do it. Or you sit wherever you want. You do it. You know, you're not plagued. The things that you're plagued by are more significant than, you know.
Yeah. Let me bring up another point here that Kohlberg is always concerned about. When he's talking about moral development, he always likes to emphasize, when I say moral, what I mean by that is not a pejorative term. I do not mean good by moral. I mean the subject matter of morality. And so I'm using the word moral as a neutral term. And so I'm simply saying that with respect to the subject matter of morality, there are six stages. And people go through stages in this order, and they don't all make stage six, and so on. But it doesn't make any sense to ask whether or not a stage six person is more moral than a stage four person. You maybe can talk about whether this human being is a more moral human being than that human being is. But you can't ask whether stage six is more moral or even a higher stage of being moral in a pejorative sense, you know, of being a good person. It's simply that this is the structure, this is the way it operates. And some people function on this level, and some people at this level, and they shift from this level, and so on. And you can tell what level they're on by the reasons they have for what they do. But you might have, I think it's conceivable to have individual A, who is a sixth-level human being, who is less moral as a person than person B, who is at stage four.
If the level three then has to do ways of thinking about
it. Yeah, and the reasons you have for what you do, or you know, the whether you can articulate them or not.
So there wouldn't be a stage six person who was utterly unreflective about these things and inarticulate.
No, couldn't be.
Simple man of faith that I.
But he may. But he could be. You know, he could be an Einstein-like person in the world of physics, or. Or a Buddha-like person in the world of theology who, when you ask him why he did what he did, he gives you a response that, you know, you spend the next 10 years figuring out, but it's in very simple words.
I make much bigger, yeah, okay, we might be talking the same language. This might be where Bill and I diverge in our understanding of culture. So I want to at least say that. I personally don't put as much stress on the articulation aspect of it, even though I have to confess that Colburn does talk about talking into additional sets of morality. But it seems to me that that we can somehow internalize a value system into our very fiber, where we have worked through the inconsistencies of the value. And it might be a simple value system, but it is an intact one. It has great integrity. It's not riddled by conflict. And I think both the capacity of getting into a value system and ingraining it into your behavior without reconceptualizing it in terms of words or reverbalizing it is an absolute necessity.
Like, you know, a puppy or something like that, and a puppy uses a faithful and does what brings impression. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, sort of an extreme example of take one.
No.
And so on.
But you're talking there either about a gaining acceptance or gaining approval or avoiding punishment. And that could be indeed a puppy level. But this is not the same thing as a stage six person who has counted the cost of being and can being in relationship with other people and being in relationship with the physical world, but can proceed on his or her own terms. Now that, whatever that his or her own terms may be, it's not always kind of wetting the finger and saying, which way is the wind blowing today? Are they smiling or are they frowning? You know, but there is the serenity. I don't know, I haven't seen a serene puppy dog, but you may, whatever.
I think, Harold, that Kohlberg is probably thinking of a stage six person as being somebody very much like Immanuel Kant, writing the principles of the metaphysics of morals, and very, very capable of articulating the ground and foundation of everything. Now, what I suggested to you is what I think is a better interpretation of stage six and less culturally conditioned than what Colbert did. And something that I think can be applied more broadly than Colbert's sense of stage six can be. Colbert has a problem with virtue, and a few of the guys whacked him on that and said, look, you know, you're coming up with the ontological ethics. It's all strictly duty. Where does virtue come in here? Where does the good life come in here? That's it. You know, there's one virtue, it's justice. And he said, no, there are a whole lot of other virtues. And we're talking morality. There are a whole lot of other virtues that are important. And you can't reduce it all down to justice.
I had another question before there. I got one now, but where does the joy of giving you
Do you have a question that very much relates to what Harold just brought in, because it's a virtue-type question.
Right. I mean, is it just the duty, and is it just our ministry, our obligation? This bothered me the other day, too, when we were talking about the gap between rich and poor and our obligation to them. I mean, if everything's an obligation, you're going to burn out pretty soon, I think. But if your morality, if your whole process is built on loving and the joy of giving, is that sixth level? Is that something that comes all along the way, or where does that enter in? I mean, that, at least for me, that is the basis
where we are. Yeah, I would judge it as beyond four.
Yeah. I think, again, there are several elements connected with that. And I think it's characteristic also of the advanced stages five and six. Like, the joy of giving can have an unabashed, self-rewarding thing. It makes me feel great to give.
Right. Yeah.
But it also has another component, and that's what revs it up to an advanced level, and that is, it's also right to give.
Right.
It makes me feel good. I get a personal out of satisfaction out of being able to share what I have with someone else, But I also say, yeah, it's right, too. It's, I'm constrained by it.
But it's not duty.
Right.
I mean, giving already presupposes duty. It's something other than it. It's a contrary. It's a logical contrary of duty. When we're talking the kind of ethics that we're familiar with, if there were no duty, there couldn't be anything which was joyful giving.
Yeah.
Now you can also develop an ethics where there isn't any duty and where the whole business is the ethics of giving. And it operates out of, I mean, it's kind of a fullness ethic. And where you are motivated by love to give. And mm-hmm. duty has nothing whatsoever to do with the whole business.
I mean, just things like that easily come with you.
And you have a sharing
people
community.
To be where they need to be, and yet giving to them, accepting them, and yet being a living testimony and being doers and not hearers only. And the whole thing.
That, I sort of question that, though, too, because loving and giving has its own level, too. Battering parents can be very loving and giving to their children, but it's a warped kind of loving and giving. So that's kind of a dangerous
yeah,
area
yeah.
to talk about.
But there is a pruning. The vine does not produce enough fruit. So there's giving is,
yeah.
it takes on different forms.
But getting back to the child that was mentioned earlier in the punishment reward thing, I think this is works out. But if you get beyond punishment and move on into discipline, and realizing that discipline is not punishment, which many people think it is, and that discipline is something necessary. That punishment isn't. You don't have to punish discipline. That you can give directives and it. On a practical level, then, I'm sure you've heard many people, parents and teachers and adults say to a child, if they spill something, for example, say, well, you know better than that. And that's very condescending, and there's punishment that follows that. But if you set up a system of discipline where the child knows that if he spills something, then he cleans it up. Whether it was right or wrong, the fact is that was spilled. Or whatever was done that was done wrong was done. But then, so you do something to correct it or straighten it out or something. Because there is, and I think this relates also to the other question you were asking of, there is forgiveness. So if you do a sin, then you ask for forgiveness. And there is no unforgivable sin than not to love God. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, right. My only other question is, yesterday, and it seems to make useful sense to say that the first stage is us under the law, the second stage is imitation of Christ, and the third stage is God within us.
Mm-hmm.
And the child gets to that level. The word baptism threw you off a little. What I really was asking was 5-year-old Andy changing by virtue of his acceptance of Christ to a different possibility for morality. I mean, that's a really tough question, I know, but that's where I'm struggling. Because I think that when we really take Christ within us, we have the right motivation because he gives us the strength to heaven.
But also from a psychological sense, and that's why I was tossing something else back to you, Phyllis, from a psychological sense. What has happened psychologically to the individual is they have had an experience of interior motivation where prior to that point there has been external motivation. And so I was saying, look, does something happen to the stage at which they are? Now I know with adults, anybody that's been in the ministry for any number of years knows that you can have some very remarkable changes that take place in people's behavior as a result of conversion. Including, you know, people moving from manifest sin to saintliness, you know, and there are any number of people in the history of the church that have been identified that way.
in terms of Kohlberg's stages, which seems pretty petty, to be setting up to explain what happened there. Mm-hmm. And granted, we're talking only about the moral side of that person's career. I think what has happened is there has been a stage shift.
Could I throw in a thought, though, that when I first heard it outraged me, and when I revisited again and again, I'm beginning to perceive some things that are about right. And that is, one rather prestigious church leader just said in an address, "You must remember that Christianity is essentially an adult experience." And I can remember how being so furious at hearing that. It's essentially an adult experience. He didn't say God's grace was essentially an adult experience, but he was saying Christianity is essentially an adult experience. And in many respects, he was right on target, that when we talk about the development of children, their mediation possibilities are initially very concrete, and they are people. We never as adults leave this either. God's also given us tangible means of grace. But essentially, this notion of God's goodwill toward man in terms of mediation to a child has to be mediated in terms of, you say you talk God, what do you do? And if we, as parents, talk Jesus, how do I understand Jesus? Not the way you talk it, but how do you treat me? How do you do it to me? How do you do this thing, Christianity, to me? I don't know whether we can even extend it beyond this. Well, of course, it can't be extended beyond this right now in terms of our own time limit. But I think it's a kind of useful thought to perhaps even end it with, Bill. I don't know.
I wanted to throw in something entirely irrelevant, and that was, we gave you that other example at the end of the period yesterday. Did you try that out on anybody? But husband and wife, where the wife is dying of cancer and the druggist had a miracle drug that would cure her, only the husband didn't have enough money to pay for it, so he stole it. Did you try that out on anybody or think about that? You didn't have to. Yes?
Tried it out on our 8-year-old, and it was just too complex, but okay. He did say that from what he could pick out of it, receiving was wrong. That was all, and that technology was wrong. But it was just too complicated.
Yeah, I figured it would be.
Take the other type of story where there are two people that can be saved and only one kind of only one dose of medicine. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you don't know what you might do before he's stole. You might just try to raise the money or get a friend.
A lifeboat type example where there's not enough to go around. Whom do you save? You tend to get involved when you get into that problem. You tend to need more data, or you feel you need more data. Now, what can you tell me about this person? What can you tell me about that person? Is this person more important to the world than that one? And, you know, and you start running into those very pragmatic kind of issues. What tends to happen is it gets to be pretty much level 2 debate, which is the utilitarian level, which, and so you look for the prudential, the utilitarian kind of way of getting out of the box.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Since I won't be here after today, I was wondering if you have anything that you could read or hand out of techniques or things to help develop the moral development of children that perhaps do not have the opportunity of having it at home in schools and things like that.
It's a very frustrating area. About the closest to this that you can get in terms of materials in print is a whole lot of stuff that's around called values clarification, which goes only to the point of giving you various kinds of techniques which you can use in the classroom to enable children who are at a reflective level of development, which would be middle grades on up, to arrive at some kind of idea of what their own values are.
and go to the point then of where you can have sharing of values and comparing their values with one another if they wish. Now, the primary problem that you have in the American publishing industry, as well as American education, public education, is they're deathly afraid that they're going to be speaking against somebody's values. Now, one of the things that is particularly fascinating about Kohlberg is that Kohlberg has suggested, with his six stages, that there is a certain objective set of values that hold for all cultures. Consequently, you can do this kind of thing and you won't go against the First Amendment to the Constitution. And and if somebody objects to what you're doing, you can say, look, this holds for everybody. You know, this is not anti-Jewish, this is not anti-Christian, this is not anti-Buddhist or whatever. See? Now, whether or not this is going to happen, I don't know. But if there are enough people who think that it is, you're going to find some books starting to come out on teaching morality in the school, but it's too early at this point for that to happen. And values clarification is about the closest you get.
I don't know. Is this question rather widespread in terms of an interest? We could get some materials together if there would be an interest in this.
I think because you hear the theory a lot, but you never really get down to practical work.
Yeah. There are, as Bill suggested, the literature is comparatively lean, but there is literature. And it's possible that we could work out some bibliography and just simply announce that it would be available someplace. I don't know how they work these things here.
Has anyone here worked with PET? I have it. This is
more personal. Interested in a bibliographic sheet on this, that we would have some notion of this. About a handful. We could work through some of that.
Those of you that are leaving, why don't you, Dwayne is going to be carrying out a longer night in the village, why don't you leave your name and address with Wayne, mm-hmm. and then when the materials are developed, the village will send it to you. Okay?
My master plays a game with a teenager called Bond Trouble, where they have to eliminate people who are going to be saved by bombs. And it's just self-preservation. They just about kill each other to get under the table.
you know,
to get people that are going to have to be taken out, and it's very vicious.
Right. It doesn't get too moral. It's interesting that each of our denominations, by means of their mission boards, make a kind of decision about who shall be given the saving gospel and who shall not, since we can't afford to take it to everybody. And I dare say that no mission board ever thinks about what they're doing by what they're doing. I expect if they did, they would be more ecumenical than they are.
Is a sequel called Holocaust?
Yeah. Well, you've been a very good group, and this has been fun and frustrating.